gravity where we are alive.
All right. Well, welcome everyone. My name is Dave Berkowitz, and I'm the AD or Assistant Director for the U.S. National Science Foundation's Directorate for Mathematical and Physical Sciences, or MPS. And I'm delighted to welcome you to today's Smart Health Frontier Symposium that has the title Driving Innovation with Fundamental Science, Precision Medicine Through Mathematics and Statistics. We have three distinguished panelists who'll be speaking today, all at the interface of mathematical and statistical science and biomedical technology. Before we get into their talks, I want to highlight some of the features of the Smart Health program that undergirds their work. We are hosting this symposium to celebrate the 10-plus anniversary. 10-year plus anniversary of the Smart Health Program. It's a multidisciplinary collaboration between the National Science Foundation and the National Institutes of Health. And the Smart Health Program is designed to accelerate innovative research in this area, bridging the gap between biomedical, fundamental biomedical research, the mathematical sciences, and transforming biomedical and science and public health in the United States in so doing. A key component of this has been to create sustainable partnerships among mathematicians, statisticians, scientists, engineers, and biomedical researchers so that we can ensure the most innovative and transformation research going forward and targeting the most relevant biomedical questions. We would like biomedical research to take full advantage of the power of mathematics and statistics. As they build their programs, as they build out their research directions. Advances in mathematics, AI, and other technological informations are poised today to make widespread changes in the delivery of medicine ultimately and in biomedical research. But the integration of these advancements in fundamental science, MPS science, with health-related science has been somewhat slow, and it is our intent to catalyze this. Today's symposium is going to showcase how advances in math can develop novel approaches to precision medicine that have the potential to be paradigm shifting in healthcare and improve the health of millions of Americans. Wider adoption of such emerging approaches will not be possible without a principled assessment of such new techniques to ensure their reliability, safety, and fairness. So this seminar will showcase how math and statistics and innovations in these fundamental sciences help to develop such foundational approaches in precision medicine. Attacking such diverse problems as individualized risk assessment for glaucoma, AI-assisted stroke rehabilitation, and predictive models for maternal health for women of color. Together, mathematical and statistical researchers and the biomedical community can bring this research to fruition to generate a healthier United States of America. And with that, I would like to pass the baton to my esteemed colleague, Wendy Nilsson, who from the SAIS Directorate, who will introduce our speakers. Wendy?
Great. Thank you, David. We're so grateful to be partnering with the MPS Directorate as well as with our colleagues at NIH. So it's an exciting effort. So we're going to have three wonderful speakers today. Carlos Fernandez Granda, sorry, Carlos, I messed that one up. And Annie Chu, and then Christopher Weichel will be presenting. And I'm going to introduce each one specifically as they go, but I'm going to take these slides down now. And I'm going to let Annie put her slides up while I give you a brief on Annie. Annie Chu, PhD, is the Chancellor's Professor, Department of Statistics at the University of California in Irvine. Her research focuses on solving fundamental issues regarding structured and unstructured large-scale data and developing cutting-edge statistical methods and theory and machine learning and algorithms for personalized medicine, text mining, recommender systems, medical imaging data, and mobile health data for complex heterogeneous data. Before joining UC Irvine, Dr. Chu was the data science founder, professor of statistics, and the director of Illinois Statistics Office at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign. She also serves as the Journal of the American Statistical Association Theory and Methods co-editor from 2023 to 2025, and as an IMS program secretary from 2021 to 27. With that, I'm going to hand it over to Dr. Chu.
Thank you, Wendy, for the very kind introduction. Also, I'm very grateful for this opportunity, which allowed me to share my research. Also, before I start it, also, I'd like to thank Yuri Gear organize this event. So, So first, let me give you some introduction to wearable health technology. Wearable devices actually are transforming our healthcare. More and more people are wearing wearable devices, such as smartwatch, smart ring, Fitbit. I can just show you, and this is the smart ring I'm currently wearing every day. So there are a lot of applications for wearable device, and today I'm going to just focus on the wearable device, which can track our stress and sleep, and also physical activity. So you can see this screenshot. This is actually from my own data for one night. You can see there's my sleep parameter, which have a deep sleep, rapid eye movement time, light sleep, and total duration time, and also has a minimal heart rate. And so I didn't just have all the screenshot. Actually, for this data, you also have heart rate a variability, which is a physiological measurement to track our physiological stress. So you see that you wear the smart ring just for one day, you get a lot of information, and also have my step track movement and exercise intensity. On the right screen, I also show you, this is a mobile app we develop. We call this Ecological Momentary Assessment, EMA tracking, which also, this is kind of subjective measurement for our emotion and well-being. So how happy you are, how content you are, so forth. So for this type of a data, we encounter some unique challenges. I'm going to talk some of the challenges, probably not list all. And this challenge will also motivate us to develop innovative statistics methodology. First, we realize we have this irregularity due to this kind of we call multi-resolution observation. So this occurs like suppose you have this non-uniform time intervals within each time series. So this is not surprising because always keep in mind that we are doing observational study. You have no control people when to wear and when not to wear, okay? People just take off their ring or take off their watch when they take a shower or do the battery charge. And also we have this varying time intervals across multiple time series. And I'm gonna give a little bit more details a little bit later. And in addition, on the top of that, we also have a lot of irregularity among subjects. In particularly, this high heterogeneity among the subjects. We also encounter large missing data, we have already mentioned, due to the observational studies. And some data, some project, we also have very small sample size. For example, for the pregnant woman, we are only able to recruit about 20-something subjects, and that's all we have. So getting a little bit more details about multi-resolution time series data. So we have measured many measurements, including your movement, your heart rate variability to measure your stress, and also your well-being. So very commonly that it's impossible. You're going to measure them at the same resolution. There's no point you ask someone, say, are you happy every 5 minutes, right? So it's a totally pointless. And also some longitudinal data could have a low resolution due to the technical limitation because some data was calculated based on the other measurements. And therefore you need to require certain accumulated information to do the calculation. And here I give you an example about the irregularity and heterogeneity among subjects. So some people are morning person, some people are evening person. So you clearly see the stress level really vary across different subjects. And we also notice on the right figure, we notice the observation time and the frequency of measurements also fluctuate among the different individuals. So the first figure is about the heart rate, and the low figure is about the stress. You see the different resolution and different time points and different gap, and the points, the measurements are missing. So how can we handle these challenges? So I'm talking about data integration in a sense that we have this observed time series with all the irregularity. So the idea is that can we sort of do some transformation in a sense that we can project this multi-resolutional time series into this dynamic latent space. And therefore this irregularity with a lot of missing data can be transformed to be more continuous, more informative, latent information. And this represent this dynamic latent representation. The reason we can do this, because there are intrinsic correlation among all this time series. Therefore, we can borrow information among this correlation to do this projection. In addition, we can also borrow information cross subjects, because clearly certain physiological phenomena also shared among all subjects. For example, if the room temperature is very high and everyone's heart rate is going increase. Okay, so this applies for everyone. And this also I learned over the time that when if you want to have a good night's sleep, you try to make sure your room temperature as low as possible, as you can tolerate. And this really helps your sleep because make your heart rate slow down. Okay, so I'll give you a little bit more details. So how can we handle this both individualized information and also population-wise common information? So here we do the model to this decomposition in a sense that we have a dynamic latent factor, theta, which is use information from individual information. And this can capture the individual trend. On the other hand, we also can borrow information from the population-wise subjects. And this is captured by latent factor F. And through this kind of a multiplication, we also say in the product, we are able to capture this interaction effect among the individual effect and the common population-wise information. So we can better explain the data. Okay, so give you more example. When we're doing this kind of modeling, we are able to achieve something other method that they are not able to achieve. So here the figure, the top figure is the heart rate, and the blue dots is observed the training data. So suppose you know all the information. And the low figure is about the stress figure. And you notice that in one time period, the data points are missing, that we don't have the observation during this time period. Using our method, we're able to capture that during this time period, the stress level actually very high for this subject. Okay, so this is very useful. So in contrast to other methodologies such as the deep recurrent neural network, the green line, the measurements, the prediction pretty much flat. So they're not able to incorporate the information from the heart rate, infer that the stress level is also very high during this time period. Now, notice that during this time period, there's no exercise. So there's no reason why the person suddenly have a heart rate, except the stress level could be very high. Okay. So if you're interested in more details, you can also check our paper. Another thing I want to talk about, this is the oral ring data for the pregnant woman. We find both homogeneous finding and heterogeneity finding. So for example, it's actually not surprising that if you have a more deep sleep, it will lead to a low stress. And actually, if you have a more REM sleep, which is when you have a vivid dream, your body is frozen during the rapid eye movement. Your body is frozen, but meanwhile, you could have vivid dream. If you have a more REM sleep, it links to high stress. And also low resting heart rate links to the low stress. And also older pregnant women tend to have a high stress and high pre-pregnant BMI also link to the high stress. On the other hand, we find some heterogeneous among this subgroup. For the subgroup with very high emotional distress level measured by EMA data, we show that walk more steps help to relieve their stress level. But for the moderate and the low emotional distress group, the more walking doesn't have a significant impact to lower their stress level. Here, the IMSSD is a high is a better and low is a worse for the stress. So come down to the conclusion and some discussion. So today, actually, I kind of really focus on about the stress management. We are aware that chronic stress could link to the mental health issue and also could link to the chronic disease, even cancer. And therefore, if our methodology can help us interpolate the unobserved time points where the data was missing, but we're able to do a precise prediction for the stress prediction, this will be useful to do the better stress management. And also we talk about some statistic methodology, for example, how to address the heterogeneity, multi-resolution time series data, low sample size, informative missing. I want to point out that data integration is a key. On the one hand, we can use data integration to alleviate heterogeneity. For example, we can extract shared information from this heterogeneous source, for example, the multimodality and heterogeneous subjects for better pattern discovery and interpretation. On the other hand, we can also use data integration to harness the heterogeneity. Sounds like a contradiction, but they're not. We can borrow information across heterogeneous sources to improve the individual prediction to enhance the precision modeling. So also we could do some statistic inference such as a conformal prediction. We can quantify this uncertainty on prediction. So this is the last slide to talk about the current, we also recruit UCI graduate students and postdoc from STEM field and health science. We try to gain better insight about their stress variation using one's oral ring, look like this, and also the EMA mobile app we have developed. So thank you for your attention. And this is the last acknowledgement.
Thank you so much, Dr. Ju. We're gonna hold questions till the end. And I think, and we'll hold some questions to the end. And unless you have a specific question about that one of the presentations, I think it'll be best if we save till the end. So thank you, Dr. Chu. That was fabulous. And I'm going to introduce our next speaker. And Dr. Weichel can start putting his slides up. There we go. Dr. Weichel, Christopher Weichel is PhD, is a curator's distinguished professor of statistics at the University of Missouri. He obtained his PhD from Iowa State University and has been on the faculty from the University of Missouri for 27 years. His research specialty is spatiotemporal statistics with applications to geophysical processes, complex biological processes, and the environment. He focuses on developing computationally efficient deep hierarchical Bayesian dynamic spatiotemporal models motivated by scientific principles with more recent work at the interface of deep neural modeling and statistics. He's a fellow of the ASA, IMS, ISI, and AAAS, and has published two award-winning books in spatiotemporal statistics. With that, Dr. Weichel, I'll let you go.
Great, thank you so much. It's a pleasure to be here to celebrate the 10-year anniversary of this awesome collaborative program between NSF and NIH, and for me to represent my colleagues in this interdisciplinary team. And with that, let me just say this is my group, and I'm putting it up at the beginning because I want you to recognize that it's multiple institutions and multiple individuals across all sorts of disciplines: statistics, engineering, computer science, applied math, physicians. And it's a real collaboration in the sense that everybody is actually contributing to everything here. So it's really wonderful. So let me just get started. So what's glaucoma? Well, it's a degeneration of your optic nerve and the loss of cells on your retina. And this is sort of what it looks like if you have it, and as it progresses, and you can see you sort of your vision starts decreasing from the outside in. And it is the leading cause of irreversible blindness in the US and in the world. Its prevalence changes, of course, depending on race, ethnicity, and location and age, but it's a major problem. So how's it diagnosed? Well, you know, obviously, if you start seeing vision problems like mentioned here, that would be a clue, but you can also test for that using visual field testing. And that's a fairly non-invasive procedure, and many of you might have had that done before. To really solidify it, though, you would have to go in and look at the structural damage, and you would use cameras, for example, to look at the optic nerve and other things that are very specialized, and not a lot of clinics would not have access to that information. So what causes glaucoma? Well, we don't really know. We do know that it's often associated with increased ocular pressure. Interocular pressure, or IOP, is just the pressure inside your eyeball. And when that starts pushing on the optic nerve, it can actually damage it. Often IOP is used as a surrogate for glaucoma, and that's because it's really the only treatable factor. And so when you go to an optometrist, they'll check you for glaucoma, and what they're really checking is your IOP. But unfortunately, it's not the only risk factor. And in fact, it's not a very good one, in the sense that people with high IOP often do not develop glaucoma. And many of the people who have glaucoma don't have elevated IOP. And in fact, if you treat high IOP, about a third to a fourth of the people who have glaucoma still progress to blindness. So it has poor sensitivity and poor specificity. So one of the things we're interested in is what other easy to measure risk factors might play a role here that would help us on an individualized basis to diagnose and project the progression of glaucoma. And so it's a multifactorial disease, sort of many things that could be a factor. And I'm going to focus on blood pressure because it's so easy to measure. And we know that blood pressure is a risk factor and is supported by many studies. But unfortunately, these results are not very consistent. In some cases, low blood pressure has shown to be a factor. And in other cases, high blood pressure has shown to be a factor. So one of the main goals of what we're doing here is to come up with trying to understand the balance between IOP and blood pressure to help us with sort of individual diagnosis and treatment plans. So let's look at that blood pressure and IOP a little bit more. And so can we sort of identify subgroups of glaucoma levels or different stages of glaucoma through just these two measurements? And so there are studies that have looked at this, I'm focusing here on the Indianapolis Glaucoma Progression Study, which was kind of unique because it was one of the few longitudinal studies. And so we have 7 years worth of data every 6 months on 115 individuals. If you look at that and you look at those individuals and you try to cluster them with regards to IOP and a measure of blood pressure, and the mean arterial pressure is just a linear combination of systolic and diastolic. Unfortunately, there's no discernible clusters that can be that come out of that. And so the answer to this question seems to be no. But those things by themselves don't really talk about what's happening inside the vascular structure of your eyeball. And so the purpose of our project is to look at physiology informed machine learning to see if we can help with this. And so the basic idea is we obtain a suite of physiologically relevant features, and we get that through a mathematical model of the ocular hemodynamics of the eye. So basically, people might call this a digital twin these days, which is we have a numerical model of the vascular structure of the eye, and we use information from the real world to inform that. And then that tells us something about the model, and we kind of go back and forth on that. So our team has developed that. And then so we use the features that can come out of that model in a machine learning or inferential framework. And so in particular, we can take inputs that you could easily get from the at your clinic with IOP and blood pressure, run it through this mathematical digital twin, get these physiology enhanced data sets, do some machine learning or your favorite type of clustering, and then show that that is significant in some sense and leading to towards progression or structural progression and functional progression of glaucoma. And then finally, we want to find out if clinicians will actually use this. So what did we find? Well, in that Indiana study, those data, we found that the 12-dimensional data set, this physiology enhanced data set, does in fact lead to discernible clusters. And this is sort of projecting that 12-dimensional cluster space into three dimensions so you can visualize it. And you can see there's three distinct clusters there. And the important thing about those clusters is that we looked into that in the study. We actually had other measurements on subjects so we could actually identify the stage of glaucoma they were at. And so what we find is that those three clusters actually do correspond to significantly different vascular behavior and glaucoma behavior in these individuals. And so the nice thing about that is it suggests a very simple way, if this holds up, a very simple way that clinicians could actually evaluate this on the spot. And so, for example, if I take this three-dimensional cluster cloud and I project it into the blood pressure IOP plane again, you can see now there are those clusters. Now, they're not perfectly separated here in this only two dimensions, but it's pretty good. And in fact, we could, if we do something like a support vector machine to identify regions in that space, then we find that a clinician could actually use this quite simply. They could measure your IOP, they could measure your blood pressure, convert it to MAP real quickly, and then see where you fall in here. And then based on that, we know what the progression is likely to be from our results for where you fall in this group. And for example, the green group there is kind of the best group in the sense that they typically do not find that we find that they do not progress in their glaucoma, whereas other ones are much worse. And so what we're doing now is we're sort of using transfer learning to other studies here to see if this holds up. And we're also trying to understand a little bit better the progression of the disease based on our physical model. So another component of this work is about uncertainty quantification. And this is one of the parts that's dear to me and what I work on a lot. And the reason for this is because we have a mathematical model that's deterministic, but yet we know there's all sorts of uncertainties in various places, including the inputs. And so, for example, if I'm interested in thinking about how somebody's hemodynamics in their eye is going to change throughout the day, as a function of their blood pressure and heart rate and IOP, those things change throughout the day. We know that there's a diurnal cycle. In fact, Annie's talk kind of shows that to some extent too, that there's uncertainty here. And so we could say, well, let's just do a Monte Carlo analysis by running our mathematical model many times with these inputs over this diurnal cycle throughout the day, and we could see what happens. But the problem is the mathematical model is expensive to run. So what we do is we build a surrogate statistical model to emulate the mathematical model, which is very fast to simulate. And so in particular, it's a what I would call a hybrid statistical extreme learning machine, sort of hybrid neural statistical model, which is the things that my group works on. And then what it gives us is this is just one of the variables from the mathematical model, but now not only do we get uncertainties, but we can start looking at different scenarios very quickly. Like what happens under the case where you have high blood pressure and normal IOP or high blood pressure and extreme IOP and vice versa. You can look at all these different things with uncertainty. And so then we can start actually making some imprint about that and how things are likely to change. So I just want to emphasize it would be impossible to measure these things with current technology, something like the mean blood pressure in the central retinal artery over this many subjects over this amount of time. That would not be possible. So the last thing that I wanted to say that we're doing that I'm excited about is that we also want to know how physicians would react to this. What's their take? And so we did this pilot study to understand whether clinicians and ophthalmologists would use AI if it came about. And you can see some of the questions here. And again, this is a small study with only 18 participants, but it's just an idea to get an idea what people would say. And you can see by looking at some of those quotes that basically, if you summarize it, that they do believe AI is vital to ophthalmology and machine learning is vital, and that it will inform their practice. But they still think there needs to be a balance between the computer, what the computer tells them, or what the AI or the statistics tell them, and then what they see themselves in their clinical practice. And they recognize there's some challenges still to this in terms of integrating this into their actual practice, even though we've shown it can be quite simple, but also just making sure that everyone would have access to this. And so we have an ongoing study that's also trying to understand how ophthalmologists currently use blood pressure to inform their assessment of patients. And that study is still, we're wrapping up recruitment, that'll be done really quickly here, and surveys are going out. So just to conclude, this sort of physiology-enhanced digital twin, machine learning, statistical approach, I don't know, we don't have a good title for the whole thing, but it's very promising, and it's really exciting because there's all this cross multidisciplinary collaboration going on for each one of these components. I personally knew nothing about the hemodynamics of the eye, even though I'm kind of a dynamicist by training. I found it fascinating, and so I'm super interested in the mathematical model as much as I am the machine learning and the statistics of this project. So some of the things we have left to do, some transfer learning to other studies, getting better use of the uncertainty that comes from our fuzzy clustering mechanism, building a more complicated PDE-ODE to simulate the space-time structure of the eye mathematically, and building a statistical emulator of that, and then finishing this last study or the second study on ophthalmologist use of blood pressure. So that's where we are. And it's like I said, I just want to emphasize how fun this project is. And if you have any questions, feel free to email me, and I'm happy to send you some references on request.
Dr. Weichel, thank you so much. That was fabulous. And last but definitely not least is Carlos Fernandez from Granda. And he's the Associate Professor of Mathematics and Data Science at New York University. During his PhD, he developed a mathematical theory of super resolution methods based on convex optimization. Since joining NYU, his group has focused on the design and analysis of data science methodology with particular emphasis on machine learning motivated by applications in medicine, climate science, and scientific imaging. I'm going to turn it over to you now. Thank you.
Thank you very much for the kind introduction. Can you see my slides?
Yes.
All right, thank you. So today I'm going to talk about a new method for anomaly detection based on model confidence that we apply to a medical application. Let me begin with the motivating application. We're interested in stroke. Stroke, as many of you probably know, corresponds to lack of blood flow or bleeding in the brain. And unfortunately, it's a very serious medical problem in the United States and worldwide. In the US, there are around 800,000 strokes a year currently. A lot of patients that suffer from stroke afterwards have to endure serious long-term disability, which is a terrible problem for them and their families. It reduces mobility in more than half of stroke survivors, age 65 and older. A key challenge that we looked at in this study is how to quantify and or monitor impairment in stroke patients in a practical way. So first, I'm going to tell you how impairment is quantified in stroke patients right now. And the way it is these patients, basically there needs to be a technician or an expert rather perhaps, who interviews these patients and sees how they move different limbs, different parts of the body, like their shoulder, their elbow, and essentially writes down the mobility for each of these joints. And this can take up to 15 minutes and again requires a trained expert. So it's very costly in terms of human resources and also in terms of time. Current assessment, as I said, is time-consuming and requires an expert. Our goal is to try to perform this quantification of impairment directly from video or wearable sensor data. This could enable monitoring patients in a, like at a higher time resolution, so more often, so they don't have to come into the clinic to have some expert do the assessment. It would perhaps be more objective as it wouldn't depend on what expert is making the assessment. And it would be affordable because it wouldn't rely, like it wouldn't require an expert to be involved or the patient to go to the clinic. This is a visualization of a wearable sensor data here on the left and also a video of a patient performing a rehabilitation task. You can see the sensors on the patient's back and on the patient's arms. And the data on the left correspond to accelerations and rotations of the sensors. The idea is to try to automatically quantify the degree of impairment of the patient from such data. Let's see if I can, yeah, okay. So we run into a big problem when we try to apply standard machine learning methodology to solve this challenge, which is that the largest av publicly available data set consists of data from 51 patients. So, for a machine learning, in order to train and test a machine learning model, this is way too little. And this is a pervasive problem. There are basically very little data available with the corresponding impairment level of the patients. Therefore, we had to get a bit creative and we developed a framework which uses AI models that are not trained on the stroke patients, but rather they're trained on a healthy population. And then we use those AI models to quantify the deviation of a patient's movement from normal motion, and that allows us to quantify their degree of impairment. Let me explain in more detail. This is an anomaly detection problem because, again, we're measuring the deviation from normality. We want to quantify to what extent data differ are different from our reference population. We call our method confidence-based characterization of anomalies. You will see in a moment where the confidence part comes in. And that's why there's a cobra dressed as a doctor here. The idea is actually relatively simple. So we train a model to perform a clinically relevant task to what we're interested in, which in this case is stroke impairment caused by stroke. And we train this model to perform this related task, which is going to be identifying what motions people are doing on a healthy population. And then we use the model confidence when applied to a new patient to determine to what extent the movements of this new patient are anomalous, to what extent they deviate from normal movement, and that allows us to quantify the degree of impairment in the patient. The basic task that our AI model is performing is identifying what movements the patients are performing during rehabilitation. Here, I'm just showing you a hierarchy of rehabilitation activities where people mimic daily activities such as dressing, bathing, meal preparation. This involves some functional movements that are cutting vegetables, tasting sauce, stirring the pot, etc. We are interested in more basic movements that are just reaching to grab an object, repositioning an object, transporting an object, stabilizing an object, and doing nothing. So these are some examples of this movement. This is a reach. This is a patient that is going to reach an object, and we're going to train an AI model to automatically identify when the patient is doing that, when they're reaching to grab an object. This is a transport where the patient is moving an object. In this case, the arm that we see on the right is the arm that was affected by stroke, and the one which we should look at. They just moved an object. This is called a transport. Stabilizing an object is keeping an object in without moving while another hand is manipulating them. Again, we have to look at the arm on the right. And this is idle. So basically, the patient is doing nothing with their paretic arm. So we trained a neural network to automatically identify which of these simple motions were being carried out by the individuals. This is an example of how our model works. So you have to look at the arm that is enclosed by this red oval, and the model essentially tries to predict which of these actions is happening at each time. It works reasonably well. Now I'm going to get to the confidence, which is crucial for an anomaly detection process. So typically, neural networks, when they try to, or in general, machine learning algorithms or statistical models that are classifying between different classes, they typically assign probabilities to each class conditioned on the data that have been observed. So in this case, when the video of this patient is observed over a little amount of time, the model might say that it thinks that this is a reach with probability 0.1, transport with probability 0.05, reposition 0.1, stabilize 0.07, and idle 0.68. So in this case, the probability of idle is higher, and this is the class that would be assigned to this at this time. We can interpret this highest probability as the confidence of the model. If that probability is close to one, this means the model is very confident. If it's close to zero, that means that the model is not confident at all. What we realized is that when we trained a model on healthy patients and looked at the confidences over a rehabilitation session for a held out healthy patient, healthy subject, not seen previously by the model, and compared those confidences to the ones produced by the model when the data comes from an impaired patient, we realized that there was a lowering in confidence because patients are impaired and their movements are different from the ones from the healthy patients. Here you can see a histogram of the confidences for the stroke patient in red and a histogram of the confidences for the healthy individual in blue. And that's basically our method. So in our method, we train a model on healthy subjects, and then we apply the model to different patients. And depending on how the confidence decreases, that gives us a measure of impairment. I'm going to finish by showing you the results. Sorry, this went back, I don't know why. On an independent test cohort, here you can see on the x-axis our automatic score that uses this AI model trained exclusively on healthy patients based on this confidence. It's just the average confidence on each of these subjects. And the y-axis, you can see the Fugle-Meyer score, which is this score that I showed you at the beginning, that is computed based on a 15-minute interview with a trained expert. And you can see that the correlation is extremely high. This is the same for videos. In the case of videos, the correlation is a bit lower because there are certain confounding factors, such as when the patients are manipulating an object, some objects are a little bit more difficult to see. So with that, I will finish. We have developed an anomaly quantification method that is based on AI models that are trained exclusively on healthy patients, and we observe high correlation with expert-based metrics. The lessons learned are that model confidence can be very informative about deviations from normality on average, and that auxiliary labels can be very useful, even if they are only available for healthy subjects. In this case, these are the labels indicating what motions these healthy subjects were doing. And that's it. These are the papers related to this project. I want to thank my co-authors, especially Heidi Shambra at the New York University School of Medicine, who led the clinical side of this project. And I really want to acknowledge the support of NIH and NSF, without whom this research would have been impossible. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much, Dr. Fernandez-Granda. All right, so we have a few minutes left for some questions. So I'd ask all of my speakers to come back on their cameras. And we've got a bunch of questions, but I think there's some that really cross all of these. So I'm gonna start with the first question. Who are your biomedical collaborators? You doing this all on your own, or what do you all? Carlos, do you wanna start?
I just mentioned mine. So Heidi Shambra is at the NYU School of Medicine, and she's absolutely crucial for this because she gathered the data and had the pioneering idea of applying machine learning to stroke rehabilitation. And it's really been a wonderful collaboration.
Great, thanks. Dr. Chu?
Yeah, I collaborate with the School of Nursing. So we kind of keep track about the caretaker and also pregnant woman for the nursing subject.
And Dr. Weichel.
Yeah, so our collaborators are at the Mount Sinai School of Medicine and Dr. Alon Harris's group in ophthalmology there.
Great, thank you. I guess the point on here is that you can't do this alone. You've got wonderful collaborators to do what you're doing, and that brings out the best in everyone. So I one of the questions that came up here, somebody said it looks like NIH research, and I'm just, you've all had collaborations across. What do you think makes this NSF research? Is that a fair question?
Yeah, so in my case, an important part of this project was developing anomaly quantification methodology that is able to identify data that deviates from normal populations. And this is a very fundamental statistical question that connects also to machine learning, because we would want to do this from very high dimensional data. And that is, in my opinion, it is fundamental research as opposed to applied clinical research.
Great.
Yeah, in my case, both the development of the mathematical model and also the development of the emulator of the mathematical model are both mathematics and statistical methods. And so I think in that sense, it's very much NSF oriented. It's just the goal is really much broader than that.
So for our research, we originally submit to NSF, but then NSF think it's a great project, also recommend NCI to fund us. So currently our project is funded by National Institute of Health, because stress is also, chronic stress could relate it to trigger the cancer. So I would say mathematical modeling, machine learning is related to basic science for NSF. And I think these two, like NIH is more care about science and medicine discovery and the conclusion and what's the impact. But without a sound mathematical modeling and foundation of statistics, we cannot achieve this goal.
Thank you. This is, and just for our audience, I will say, even when these projects that come in through this mechanism are funded by NIH, they're picking for the same reasons NSF is. So they're looking for the same fundamental science we are, because this is the way they can bring it in and change and bring in some new scientific ideas. So it's not like there's a separate NIH idea and an NSF idea. It's fundamental science questions driving all of it. There's a question here. There's many questions about missing data. How does your analysis assume? Does it assume data is missing at random, or somebody says, is it informative missingness? How do you all deal with that? And so, Dr. Chu, I think it started with your presentation. So.
So first we have to be realistic. We talk about missing data, but let's say we have the chunk of the data that's all missing. That let's say today I know what's going on, the previous stock market going on. But if you want me to predict the stock market even a month later or a year later, there's no any information. I mean, during that period of time, the accuracy, we cannot guarantee. We have to be realistic. So here, the missing data is more like we have some information from some measurements, but a certain resolution they're missing, and you can borrow information. And also the nearby time points, so we can extrapolate or interpolate. Let's say I can predict pretty well what will happen maybe the next hour, next day. So in that sense, that it's really have to be time dependent and also resolution, the frequency dependence. So on the one hand, we can do it, but also we have to be aware of the limitation. So it's not just informative missing, because when we talk about informative missing, it's more like you have the observed associated with the future one, whether it's informative. So here it's a sometimes in reality it's very difficult to verify it's a missing mechanism.
Do any of the other have comments on that one?
I mean, I don't really for this particular study, because more of what we've done has been more exploratory at this point. So and it's a well-used data set, so all those things have sort of been worked out by now. But it can definitely be a problem. It's just not a problem for what we're doing right now.
In our case, it's also not a problem. Although the scarcity of labeled data in terms of data of stroke patients for whom we know the impairment was actually a main motivation for applying anomaly detection and trying to use models that are trained on healthy patients, on healthy individuals.
Thank you. So there's a comment again about kind of a collaboration question. How do you navigate the balance between computational and health contributions in your work? So they were saying, do you start with a computation approach and identify an appropriate health application, or do you start with the health side and then build your computation out? Pretty sure I'm going to get many different answers here. So who wants to start?
I'll start with that one. I'm actually late to this collaborative team in the sense that Dr. Harris and Dr. Guidoboni had been collaborating, I think, for years before this, and it was very much driven by wanting to understand, the what's actually happening with the hemodynamics in the eye with respect to glaucoma. So it was very much driven by the scientific question. The medical question. And then over time, it became much more of a, as data became available, it became a data question as well, and then opened it up for machine learning and statistics to come in and play a role.
Yeah, I can follow the Chris point. I think we were first approached by the domain scientist. And then during this research, we discover you can do some abstract thinkings in kind of abstract the problem for the statistics problem. So it's a real data that's very messy, and you see there's some interesting statistic problem. Then later, I decide to collect the data ourselves, because the mobile health data, compared to other domain science, may be more difficult to collect, but the mobile health is relatively easier to collect, because then we can do the smart design, we know what kind of data we want to collect and what subjects we want to approach. So we have better control even at the beginning. So it's more like I get motivated by the domain science. Then I got motivated to develop statistical methodology. And then later on, I also get involved. We actually also can collect the data ourselves. So it's a really fun project.
Great, thank you. All right. It started out with Dr. Fernandez-Granda, but I think you'll all get to this one. Dr. Fernandez, it would be great to see how this would translate to Parkinson's patients. Have you explored other applications? And I think I'd love to hear how you all see your work evolving over time. So
we have not looked at Parkinson's. I think this is a great suggestion, and we should definitely look into it. We did look at an application to disease severity assessment, because this framework where you say, oh, I have a related task that is relevant, and then I'm going to look at the confidence of a model trained on healthy subjects, can be applied quite broadly. In the application that we explored, it was we had people that suffered from knee osteoarthritis, and we had their knee MRIs, and we trained a model to segment healthy knees. And then we applied that model to these patients, and we observed again that there was a correlation between a lowering of the confidence of the model with the degree of severity of knee osteoarthritis. But we haven't looked into Parkinson's. I think it's a great suggestion.
Yeah, it was, in our case, definitely this methodology of using a physiology-enhanced data set where that enhancement comes from mathematical model digital twins, I think is sort of untapped at this point. And we are actually doing this in other areas, or starting to. It requires developing a new mathematical model for these things, for some component of the biology. But yeah, it's super exciting. I think in a way, it's just a way to expand the dimension of your input data in a way that it's scientifically meaningful. And I think there's all sorts of ways to do that that we haven't even thought of yet.
Great. Dr. Chu, do you want to weigh in on this one? Dr. Chu?
Oh, sorry.
Okay. Do you want to weigh in on this at all?
No, I'm okay. I can skip that.
Okay. Somebody's asking about AI, which, having working in the division at NSF, that is the home there, I have to ask the AI question. It says, AI has changed everything. Are we expected to conduct AI research, or is it a different approach to see further ahead? And I think you all have interesting ideas about that, because as much as we all live AI, it's not the only thing in the world. So who wants to start?
I can
start. Dr. Chu?
Yeah, so I think AI really plays a role for the future. It's already played a role for our health. For example, the smart ring. What's AI? It's about, we can think about for statistical way to thinking about the algorithm. If we can do automatic algorithm based on observe the data and give us some suggestion, which hopefully it's a sound suggestion. And I think a lot of AI cannot take into about the precision part, to the heterogeneity part. It's doing well for the homogeneous information. They can accumulate a lot of information, a lot of the data, and tell what's a general population, but for the individual, this is a very, very challenging for AI. To personalize AI, I think it's extremely challenging. And as a statistician, and we can think about how can we do even personalized large language model and personalized machine learning. So this, I think it's a future very hot topic.
In our project, AI is absolutely fundamental to deal with the high dimensional wearable sensor and video data with the methods that we used to have before the advent of deep learning. It would be almost impossible to identify these movements from this high dimensional time series or from video automatically with high accuracy. But at the same time, we run into a challenge that comes with using standard AI methods, which is we cannot just apply a machine learning method that automatically predicts impairment, because we have 50 labels of impairment in our data set, these 50 stroke patients. Instead, we have to get creative and combine AI with statistical ideas, in this case, this anomaly detection confidence-based method, in order to use it effectively.
Yeah, and just to kind of echo that, I see two things here. One, if in our project we use whatever tools the best for each component of our project. So we have deterministic mathematical modeling, we have more traditional machine learning, we have AI components. Now we have everything, whatever we need to solve that component, and then to integrate them together. And I think that's what real data analysis and data science is. My other view of it is, for as a statistician, is that I believe that AI has a lot to teach us about modeling, and we have a lot to teach AI practitioners about modeling as well. And I like this notion of being a hybrid thinker about how those things interact.
Great. Thank you all. I think it's 4 o'clock, so I'm going to have to shut off our questions. If you have, we'll be posting the video, and so look for that, because you can watch it again and learn even more. I know I really enjoyed this, and I just want to give a rousing. It's always hard to give applause because Zoom is going to kill my clap, but at least my hands are clapping. So, and I know everybody else that's on is thrilled with this. Thank you, thank you, thank you for being here with us. And we look forward to learning more about all the work that you're doing. So thanks, everyone. Thanks
Thank
for
you.
joining us.
Thank you
Thank
very much.
you.
Bye.
Okay, thank you.
Bye-bye.
Bye.